Okay, so let's move on. So we'll start this section for two today. Is unfortunately, this is a beautiful set of ideas involved into this, but I cannot be fair to them because we don't have that much time. So I just give you a taste of what it is about. The same with the next section, which is supergravity. So I will try to cover both today, just for completeness, rather than give you full details. And I will include some things about this in the example sheet, so you will have more time to enjoy this extended supersymmetric Lagrangians. So remember that so far, I have said it several times, and I can insist, is that for n equals to 1, the action depended on the essentially on three arbitrary functions, and psi, which is a parameter. So the point is that, as I told you the other day, it was good to have W and F to be holomorphic, because holomorphicity was the argument, the reason why at the end they had a very good quantum properties. For instance, W was not renormalized at any order in perturbation theory. This is probably one of the most important results for n equals to 1 supersymmetry. And F is renormalized only at one loop, and after that it's not renormalized, as I told you. Whereas K, being non-holomorphic, gets corrections to all orders. Okay, so that's what we had so far, and so let's see what happens to n equals to 2. N equals to 2. The important thing we have to notice is that n equals to 1 is called simple supersymmetry, and n equals to 2 and beyond is called extended supersymmetry. But simple supersymmetry is actually the most general in global supersymmetry. So all the other cases are particular cases of n equals to 1. So you have seen already the most general case. Okay, so that's good. Of course, more general than n equals to 1 is n equals to 0, of course. So it has no supersymmetry. So they are all particular cases. The more supersymmetry you have, the more constraints the Lagrangian are. So for n equals to 2, you can see that at the end, the Lagrangian can be written in terms of these arbitrary functions, except that there will be more constraint. There will be further constraint. So let me take, for simplicity, just the case of a vector. The vector superfield for n equals to 2. And the vector, it will include, you can write it, remember, for the vector multiple, we wrote it like this, lambda, a mu, psi, and phi. And this one was an n equals to 1 vector so it will come from an n equals to 1 vector superfield that we call V, and this one is an n equals to 1 chiral that I will call phi. Okay, so on vector superfields can be written in terms of couplings of chiral and a vector if they all come together in one single n equals to 2 multiplet. It so happens that that this particular case is the simplest, is that you can write the n equals to 2 action in terms of the n equals to 1 superfields. And so the n equals to 2 action is very simple. So the action will be very simple. Why? The reason is that you have to put together two n equals to 1 multiplies in one single n equals to 2. And for that, there will be what is called a remember the R symmetry that we talked about. So there will be a group containing SU2, an SU2 R symmetry that will relate the two supersymmetries that this will satisfy. And this put constraints on what kind of things you can have. And in the that implies that the action will be such that is zero. So no superpotential. So in the sense we will have written a superpotential as a function of this capital phi, but that is zero. But and the rest, K and F, can be written in terms of a single holomorphic function. That is, I call F, but in a sophisticated way, F of phi. And this function is called the prepotential. Okay. So this is good news, because remember that in n equals to 1 we had no information about K in quantum corrections, because K was not holomorphic. But now K will be derived from a holomorphic function, which is F. In particular, I can tell you F of phi will be the second derivative of F with respect to phi, and K of phi and phi dagger is 1 over 2i phi dagger to v df by d phi minus complex conjugate. Okay. So that means that just giving just this arbitrary function f, we find the full Lagrangian. So the full Lagrangian only depends on one single function. And this function is chiral. Being chiral, then it will get all the good perturbative corrections, all the good properties on the perturbative corrections of the Lagrangian. For instance, we know that little f is not corrected beyond one loop. So we already know that this will not be corrected beyond one loop. So then that means that we have the full Lagrangian only at one loop, which is very good. Okay, so full perturbative, of course, just one loop. And actually, people have computed that. First of all, F equals to phi square at tree level. And then they computed the one loop. And this is actually phi square log of phi square divided by lambda square, where lambda will be the cutoff corresponding scale where you're doing your calculation in the way that I mentioned before in the sense of those Wilsonian actions. And so that means that people have computed that once, and that's it. So this whole function is phi square log of phi square over lambda square. And from here, you can read now little f, capital K. And from then, you can plug it into the general expression for your Lagrangian, and then you have a full Lagrangian. Okay, you have all gauge couplings, everything, kinetic tensor scalars, everything. So this is extremely powerful. So this is, you can see how supersymmetry is so constrained that eventually just a one loop calculation gives you the full Lagrangian to all orders in perturbation theory. So this is one of the beautiful things about extended supersymmetry that is very restrictive. But of course, all this is only perturbative. So perturbative, we have the whole control on the action, but that means that in principle we can have non-perturbative corrections. So at the end, let's see. F total will then be PF one loop plus NF non-perturbative. Okay, so the F one loop is known, and the only thing that is left to be known is F non-perturbative. So knowing that, we get to know this, essentially we have control of the full theory. We have a perturbative and non-perturbative. So up to the 1990s, this was the only thing that was known, so this result that was known. And in 1994, there was this work of Cyber and Witten, and that's considered one of the great progresses in field theory in the last, say, 15, 20 years, is that they were able to get a control of this non-perturbative part also. Okay, so this is 1994 Cyber-Witten. And so this is important. This is very important. Let me just give you some story about the Cyber-Witten. So the idea is that good luck. The idea is that they have rowing competition too. Yes. So let me see. Then the thing is that you know what the difference between perturbative and non-perturbative. You have heard about what is non-perturbative? Yes. Well. Who doesn't know what non-perturbative is? Let me just.
Who knows?
Who knows? Okay. Let me.
Who does know or doesn't?
Both. First of all, who does not know what non-perturbative means? Okay.
I don't really know in this context, sure, where I know what it means usually.
Okay. Very good. Okay. So, in the sense, perturbative means that is that this will be like a series. In powers of g. So g to the n, say, times the coefficients. So that would give you all the couplings. Okay. Non-perturbative means that something cannot be written like this. So for instance, a series in the form of e to the minus a g squared times coefficients, times another coefficients, for instance. Because we know that the function e to the minus a n over g squared. Because we know that the function e to the minus 1 over g squared cannot be all the function and all its derivatives vanish at 0. So it doesn't have a good Taylor expansion. But it is there, it's correct. So you couldn't get any of this, of the information about this function from just a Taylor expansion around powers of g. So this is perturbative, this is non-perturbative. So typically effects that contribute to this are instantons and this kind of thing that you will see in the next term. So these are things that go beyond your Feynman diagram expansion. So all this you can get from Feynman diagrams, and here you don't get it from standard Feynman diagrams. but it's part of your theory. You have effects which are non-perturbative, like a tunneling effect. You go from one minimum to another minimum. It's something non-perturbative. You're not going around the minimum. You just go from one to the other one, and these things happen. And yes, for instance, yes. And so that means that these are important parts of your theory, and the Feynman diagrams don't give you the full information. So to have the full information about the theory, you need to know both. And usually, this is the less understood part of field theories, and also string theory by itself. So it was a big development in 1994 that Seibert and Witten were able to essentially control this series, the non-perturbative series here. They were able to find by using some beautiful mathematics, and in part there's something probably you have seen, the electromagnetic duality, in the context that Dirac introduced it many years ago, where you exchange electric and magnetic fields and electric charges and magnetic monopoles. So that you start with an SU2 theory here, you have a phase where it will be in the U1, and the U1 will carry that electromagnetic duality, and because of that, you can find a lot of beautiful mathematical properties that allows you to discover this non-perturbative effects here. So that is 1994. Unfortunately, I cannot go tell you details about that. If you want to know details, the review of Bilal is okay. There are many reviews on this Cyberwitten, but in the context for this course, since Bilal gives a general discussion of n equals to 1 supersymmetry, or supersymmetry in general, so he spends half of his lectures just describing this n equals to 2. So if someone is curious, that could be a good reference, but there are many other references that review this work. And in particular, the first paper, at least, of Seibert and Witten is a beautiful piece of work, so it's nice to read it. Even if you don't understand it, you just see it, it's beautiful. Okay. Okay, good. So that is n equals to 2. But of course, n equals to 2 not only has vectors of upper fields, but it also can have vector plus hyper multiplets. And in general, this can be done because vectors will include the, for instance, if you are in a vector superfield, the corresponding scalar or chiral field has to be in the adjoint because it has to be in the same representation as the vector, as the gauge field. But if you have hypermultiples, the hypermultiples have only two chiral multiples of n equals to 1, so you can have matter in different representations here. And in general, this will be more complicated. And that's the only thing I will say. That in general are more complicated. People have discussed some of this, and part of it is understood, but of course it's not as well as this. There's a second paper of Seibert and Witten where they discuss this, and of course many people after that, but in general I will not mention it. It's just to let you know it's more complicated. However, there is a particular case where vector and hypermultiplet together give you something very simple. And this is the case of n equals to 4. And for n equals to 4, the n equals to 4 vector, you can write it as n equals to 2 vector plus an n equals to 2 hyper. So let me just call this phi. I will put a phi 1 psi 1 because the hyper will have phi 2 psi 3 psi 2 and phi 3. Okay, so this will be an n equals to 2 vector. Plus an n equals to 2 hyper. And both together gives you an n equals to 4 vector, in the same way that these are 2 n equals to 1 multiples together. So all together is an n equals to 4 vector multiplet. And for this particular case, this is a very interesting case, because remember I told you that n equals to 4 is the largest supersymmetry we can have before touching gravity, without gravity. And so this is there is only one single multiplet in n equals to 4. This is without gravity. And so for this one, you can see, well, what is the effective action for this? It's more restrictive than n equals to 2. And it actually is. And the effective action actually does not depend on any arbitrary functions. There are no... Remember that n equals to 1, we had k, w, and f. In n equals to 2, for the vector case, we had only this capital F, which was the prepotential. And for n equals to 4, actually, there are no arbitrary functions. And the only arbitrary thing that you can play with is only a constant parameter, so we call tau, and tau has a real, which I call theta, or theta over 2 pi, plus I, and then I will call 4 pi over g squared. Okay. This is the term that multiplies. So remember, tau is essentially the tau is replacing the kinetic function. In this case, it's just a constant, and it's tau. So this means that real of tau is the thing that multiplies f mu in the Lagrangian. And imaginary of tau, I'm sorry, the other way around. Real of tau multiplies f mu dual. And imaginary of tau is the thing that multiplies f mu. So that means that this 4 pi over g squared is the thing that multiplies is the gauge coupling, essentially. It multiplies f mu. And theta is the coefficient of FF dual. FF dual, remember I told you it was a topological thing. Theta is usually called the theta angle. That's because this term is topological, so it's topological. But in supersymmetry, they all come together as a complex quantity, and that's called tau. And that's the only free thing you have in your whole n equals to 4 theory. So there are no free functions. So that means that this following n equals to 4 theory is exactly known. Just take n equals to 1 and just put f equals to 2 tau, and that's it. Okay. And so that is good. So you can compute, and you can see what the n equals to 4 will have several scalars and so on. You can compute what the scalar potential is and so on, and you will see that in the example sheet. So they will distribute you, so you can compute what the properties of n equals to 4 are. So at the moment, the only thing I can tell you is that since I told you already that n equals to 2 has beautiful properties, you expect that n equals to 4 has even more beautiful properties because it's higher symmetry. And it actually does, because since it only depends on this parameter tau, n equals to 4 has several good things. One is that the theory is not only renormalizable, but it's finite. Something you can get an idea of this also is that I understand you have seen already what a beta function is in quantum field theory, or in advanced quantum field theory, or in the standard model, in either of the two. Yes? Who doesn't know what a beta function is? Okay. usually the gauge couplings change with energy. That's a typical thing in field theory. That's one of the general implications of field theory, that the gauge couplings change with energy. And the way that they change with energy is especially determined by what is called the beta function. So you have the equation. So this is the tells you how the gauge coupling changes with energy. And lambda will tell you the energy, how it is. And usually, in this, beta is proportional to g cube at one loop. For, say, for n equals to 1. And in general, that this tells you, for instance, this tells you that the gauge coupling changes with energy. This is gauge coupling and energy, or lambda. And this tells you that at large energy, this is weak, and then it becomes strong. This is a standard asymptotic freedom. That's a QCD case. And QED is the other way around. QED starts weak and then becomes strong. And then you have the lambda pole at some point. So that's how it happens. However, in n equals to 4, beta is just 0. So that means that there is no change of the gauge coupling with energy. So that's the property of n equals to 4. And since beta doesn't change with energy, that means that there is a bigger symmetry in your theory. There's a conformal invariance. So for those of you who have seen string theory, string theory has conformal invariance in two dimensions. This is a conformal field theory in four dimensions. Okay, so this theory is very well behaved, very well behaved in the quantum domain. And furthermore, just to finish, I ran out of space, but furthermore, it has this duality that I was mentioned for electromagnetic duality is actually present, is fully present in this n equals to 4 theory. So there is something called what we call S duality, which is essentially taking tau to A tau plus B over C tau plus D is realized in this theory, where A, B, C, and D are integers. And so this is a what is called an SL2 Z group. And in particular, for particular choices of d of the coefficients, for instance, for d equal to 0 and a equal to 0, this goes like 1 over tau. And tau, remember that the imaginary part of tau is the gauge coupling. So if you're changing tau to 1 over tau, or that you're changing the gauge coupling from weak to strong. So this is symmetry that relates strong coupling. So this is one of the beautiful properties of this theory, that you can control the strong coupling and do I know in the weak coupling, because it's manifestly present in this theory. And so there's a strong to weak coupling duality, or S duality, and that has made this theory very, very, very good to study, and also that source of this so-called ADS-CFT correspondence. Now, probably you have heard about what ADS-CFT. That's one of the proposals of some Maldacena 7 years ago or so, and that's relating two theories which are completely different. One is in string theory on ADS space, anti-de-Sitter space in 5 dimensions, equivalent to the conformal field theory with no gravity in 4 dimensions. And what is this conformal field theory? It's precisely n equals to 4, which is conformal. So the n equals to 4 is the basis of this equivalence between two completely different theories that people have been working in the last few years. So that this is... key part of this correspondence is n equals to 4. Okay. So... yes, so this is just to give you an idea of how strong supersymmetry can be and how beautiful these things can be. Unfortunately, I cannot have more time to dedicate to this. As I say, I will include one question about potentials and so on in n equals to 4 to give you a taste of how things are nice in n equals to 4 or n equals to 2 supersymmetry. But I cannot go beyond that in this course. Okay, so that's nice. So let me just move to the next part, which is supergravity. And again, I cannot be fair to the subject because it will take a whole course by itself to discuss supergravity because it's very technical. But the idea is very simple. The idea is that we know that what is it that we know in gauge theories. That if we set a field phi going to e to the I, if alpha goes from constant something interesting happens, and that becomes then this becomes a full gauge theory. Okay, so you have to introduce a corresponding gauge field and so on. That's something we know. So what is it that we are doing? Of the space-time dependent. In supersymmetry, we know the supersymmetry transform. Phi, they're called phi, yes. Let me just call epsilon is the parameter for symmetry transformation. So the question is, what having epsilon to be not a constant, just to be a space-time dependent quantity. Okay. Okay, so I jump a little bit from here, but if we make alpha to x, we have to introduce a gauge field a mu. In supersymmetry, we have that, but we know that supersymmetry is part of the whole Poincaré algebra. It's a space-time symmetry. So we are making the supersymmetry parameter to be constant. We can make also the parameter of the whole Poincaré symmetry to be constant. And what happens when we make Poincaré symmetry constant? the parameter of point color symmetry, we make it field space-time dependent. What will happen? So we make the Poincaré symmetry, we make it local. What will happen?
General coordinate
transformation, exactly. So if we make Poincaré symmetry local, we get that means that we get gravity. Okay. So now the same thing. We make SUSY local by just setting the corresponding parameter to be a space-time dependent function by making this. This is making local. So then we get supergravity. So that's the idea of supergravity. So what is it that we have then? If we have the gravity, that means that the gravity is determined by a corresponding metric tensor that is also can be written in terms of Firbines like that. You have seen Firbines, the tetrads? Okay. So you have that for gravity. For supergravity, then you have to introduce a new field. And that what can the field be? Has to be is the field that is the partner of the graviton. Remember that we had the graviton in when we studied the multiples, and the corresponding field is a gravitino. And the gravitino will be an object which is a fermion, but carries an index. Okay, and this is for n equals to one supersymmetry. Because if you have more supersymmetries, then you do have more gravitinos. Because remember, you start with a spin 2, a helicity 2 object, and you apply the creation operator, and you get n helicity 3 halves objects for n extended for n supersymmetry. And for n equals to 1, you get only 1, but for any other n, you get as many gravitinos as the number of supersymmetries that you have. So... So this is, in some sense, this is, if you can say that the gravitino is the gauge field of supergravity. You already had the metric for gravity, so the gravitino is the gauge field of supergravity. So that's something to have in mind. So the corresponding gauge field for supergravity is the gravitino. Okay, so then the typical question is to say, well, what kind of actions we can write for that makes a supersymmetric coupling between gravitinos and gravitons, and people struggle for a while because it's a very technical thing. And finally, in 1977, there were two groups. One is the Friedman, Ferrara, and von Neuringhuysen. And the other group, like a week after. Deser and Sumino. And they found a supersymmetric way of extending the action of supergravity, of gravity. So they find the supergravity action to be d for x. Square root of g the typical Einstein term, but then there is a term for the kinetic term for the gravitino, which is this, so this is Einstein-Hilbert, and this is what is called the Rarita-Schwinger action for a spin 3/2 object. And dot 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 dot. So this is where the difficult part was. Okay. Okay. Everybody was expecting to have the standard kinetic term for both fields, and so then the rest is that you get up to four Fermion fields, and it's a long calculation, and that's what it took them some time to get it. But for us, at least, it's good to know that you can write it. But thinking about phenomenology. The interesting thing is not only how gravity coupled to itself, I mean, gravity and gravitino couples, but how the whole thing, gravity couples to matter fields in, of say, like Gauge bosons and to quarks and leptons and so on. So the question is, you can start with this, with supergravity, and then combine with what we have found about the general couplings of chiral and vector superfields, depending on K, Ws, and Fs. And if we can write a general axiom coupling that to gravity. So that will include coupling everything we know, just the gravity multiple to all matters and gauge field multiples. And that has been done. And it was done actually in full detail by Cremer et al. In 1981. So let me see. So, yes. Supergravity coupled to matter. In n equals to 1. And this is Cremer et al. In 1981. And the et al. Means that there are many authors, and the reason is that it's extremely difficult and technical, so you needed many people to check the calculations. And and they got a very nice result, and at the end of the day, things look complicated. And there are several ways to do this calculation. You can actually, they did it more or less by brute force, something called tensor calculus. And you can do it also in terms of superfields. And for that, you can see the book of Wes and Bagger. There's a whole superfield formulation of n equals to 1 supergravity, which is, I personally think it's a little bit cumbersome. So usually the techniques used by them or used by for the group, they use superconformal invariants. That may be, that's the nicest and cleanest way to do it. You start with a theory which has an extra symmetry, conformal symmetry, and at the end you break it by setting, imposing that the Einstein term, the coefficient here is just the Newton's constant. So just that breaks the conformal symmetry and fixes the rest of the Lagrangian. So that's the easier way to do it. But anyway, they are all very technical. So let me just tell you in the next 5 minutes, what is it that it is that we get? What is it that this modifies what we know? Okay. So at the end, the Lagrangian or the action will be the supergravity action, but plus a supergravity an action depending on K, W, F, and the Faye-Leopoulos, properly covariantized with the gravity. That means including with the square root of G's whenever you have in front of the whole thing, and also whenever you have derivatives, put covariant derivatives to make it invariant under gravity. So in that sense, that looks trivial, but it's not trivial. So there are more things that we will learn. So in particular, once you do that, so the Lagrangian idea will be similar to the global supersymmetry because it will depend on the same arbitrary functions, so except that the explicit expression is not the same. So so this is similar to global supersymmetry. Except there are extra things. So extras. There is an explicit, what is called a Kähler symmetry. Kähler symmetry. That was not manifest in the global case. And this Kähler symmetry is that you take the killer potential and just change it. So k will be a function of phi and phi dagger plus a function of phi plus a function of phi dagger. Okay, so and at the same time you transform, sorry for the notation, I better use the phi phi star, because I'm just talking about the first component of the superfield. Sorry about that. I better use the first component of the superfield rather than the superfield itself, because I'm just talking about the components. And W then goes to e to the HW, the same H. Okay. The important thing is that you're shifting the carrier potential by a holomorphic function, and the superpotential you just multiply by e to the H. And then that leaves the whole Lagrangian invariant. In particular, then from here you can see that there is the whole Lagrangian depends on one single combination of k and w, which is Kremer et al. Call it like a g, which is k minus log of w squared. Okay. So S depends only on this combination. And if you allow me 2 more minutes, I finish with supergravity today. So another important difference from the standard supersymmetric case is that the F term potential, scalar potential, takes the following form. B F term is e to the k times, this is one of the questions that I have written more often in my life, so I should remember it. So e to the k, I should write divided by m Planck square just to make sure how the m Planck appears. And this will give you k inverse I j star d I w d j star w star minus 3 w square. And this will come with m Planck to the square, huh? Where this di w is equal to partial w with respect to the corresponding field, di w plus di k times w. And this comes also with a factor of m Planck square. Okay, so this is called the Keller covariant derivative, in the sense that you have a partial derivative plus this term. And I noticed that two things. One is that when you set m Planck to infinity, this reduces to the standard global supersymmetric case. M Planck to infinity, this will give you e to the 0, which is 1. This covariant derivatives, this term will be 0, and then you just have a standard derivatives. So you have di, di w star, and then the k inverse. This is what we had in a standard global supersymmetric case. And this disappears. Okay, so you will get the standard, that gives the standard n equals to 1 global
pure potential.
That's the first thing. And the second, which is very important, is that now this V is not positive. Okay? Because there is a minus 3 here. So still the whole thing depends on case and W, but now the dependence on the Lagrangian is different, and in particular the scalar potential is manifestly different. And an important thing is that there is a minus 3, so you have a positive term minus another positive term. So now the energy in n equals 1 supergravity is no longer a positive quantity. And this is good or bad, depending on how you see it. I would see it as good. So we will try implications of this result. So in general, the message I want to transmit is that at the end, the whole supergravity action is well under control, and now we have a full Lagrangian or action that couples all matter, gauge fields, and gravity together, and super in the supersymmetric matter, and we know the explicit expressions for the terms depending on, again, on K, W's, and F. And okay, so you will see in the example sheets questions referring to this. Okay.